I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 7th of July. Hope your fourth weekend was absolutely splendid. All things political is what we present on Mondays at 1 o'clock, and there is a lot for us to discuss today. Since October, something like 52,000 children have crossed the border illegally, mostly from Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. Do these children possibly have valid asylum claims, or should we, as Representative Mike Rogers from Oklahoma suggests, put them on a bus like we normally do and send them back down to Guatemala? The president will be in Texas on Wednesday. Should he be making visits to these detention facilities? Should he look at what's going on along the border? And where will that $2 billion he's seeking to deal with the flood of unaccompanied children be going? We also are going to be talking about last week's Supreme Court ruling, particularly the Harris versus Quinn, which could eventually affect hundreds of thousands of unionized home health care workers. Our guest has written extensively about the cost of public sector pay and benefits and says if policymakers fail to rein in this growth, a fiscal crack-up will be the inevitable result. We'll look at the deaths of three Jewish teenagers and the revenge killing of a Palestinian teen and beating of a Palestinian American. And we'll look at this situation in Detroit where 12,500 customers had their water shut off. $560 is the average delinquency payment that is due. Should a city be able to do that, or should it just be a right that you have water? Well, our guest this hour is Daniel DeSalvo, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute Center for State and Local Leadership, assistant professor of political science at the City College of New York. He focuses on American political parties, elections, labor unions, state government, and public policy, and writes for National Affairs, The Public Interest, The Weekly Standard, Commentary, The New York Daily News, New York Post, Congress and the Presidency, and many other publications. Daniel DeSalvo, thanks so much for being with us again. Hello.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Hope the 4th was good.
It was indeed.
Yeah, I like that holiday. It's a good one. Well, let's start with all of these children. This story just sort of snuck up on us, and I guess we could ask the question, why didn't a lot of people see this coming? This is an enormous number of children, 52,000 children making this 1,000-mile trek, and it seems as though we don't know what to do.
Well, we don't. It's a very complex. Anytime you're dealing with children who are in distress and in need, you know, the saying "kid gloves" really takes on new meaning. And in that sense, exactly how to proceed and is much more. It's a much more touchy matter than if you're dealing with adults.
Right. So, should somebody? The president is taking some heat for this. Should he have seen this coming? Should Congress have seen this coming, Daniel?
Well, it's hard for them to see it coming. I mean, how much intelligence work is being done to, in a sense, it's a curious story because this is many of these parents who are sending these children are sending them presumably on the assumption that there's going to be some kind of amnesty for Dream Act, and how this, you know, in a sense, rumor got started that was powerful enough to get so many people to act on it and put their children at enormous risk is, in a way, a very interesting story. And I'm not sure our political establishment was well informed of what was happening in Honduras and Guatemala and elsewhere.
And evidently what we're now doing is running ads on television in these countries saying, please don't send your children to America.
Yeah, it's a publicity campaign to defeat this rumor that if people came and got here in time, in some sense, before a deadline, that there would be some kind of amnesty. And this indicates that communications between the United States and many Central American countries about this issue of immigration, you know, isn't the best. And in that sense, that might be an area where the United States needs to improve, because if the national government's going to take action on immigration, you know, there needs to be clear communications with many of the countries that are sending so many people across the border illegally.
Yeah. Daniel, why is it so hard for Congress to take up this issue? It's obviously in need of attention.
It is. It's an incredibly complex issue, one that touches on economics, on culture, and in that sense, on pretty much every aspect of our national life. And in that regard, it's something that both President Obama and his predecessor George Bush have been in favor of comprehensive immigration reform. The trouble with any comprehensive immigration reform is that it's always going to have some pieces in it that some people are going to like and other people aren't going to like. And therefore, forging a political coalition in Congress is very, very difficult. Just take, for example, this story about all of the children coming from Central America. If one says, well, we're going to grant some kind of amnesty to regularize the status of the 11 to 12 million people here, or pass some kind of dream act inside a comprehensive thing in exchange, let's say, for tougher security measures that's going to make it more difficult for people to come across the border or to overstay their visas. Getting that balance just right is really, really hard, and getting a coalition behind it is really hard.
Yeah. So what do you make of a comment? First of all, it brings out some really nastiness among Americans. After all, these are children, and I think that you have to look at this in a slightly different way, because you've got these little 8-year-olds and 5-year-olds who have made this long trek, and they're by themselves. They don't have their parents with them, and yet you've got some people, particularly in Southern California, who are just screaming at everybody, go home, get out of here, and yet they're children. So it requires a different kind of attention, don't you think? What do you think of this comment from a representative from Oklahoma, Mike Rogers, who said, why aren't we putting them on a bus like we normally do and send them back down to Guatemala? Why aren't we?
Well, I think that there's probably some legitimate concerns of both sending them back to whom and to what. Do we have a clear idea of who these people's parents are, who their guardians are? Are these people going to be, let's say, at the bus station to pick them up should such a bus head south? And there's obviously concern about that. And in that regard, you could see that there's why there's probably some hesitation about doing this. Again, because it's children. You know, if these were adults, you would put them on planes or buses, as our deportation system does, and send them back to their country, and they're released on their own reconnaissance.
Yeah. Well, we ask our audience, too, what they think of the situation. And a reminder, tomorrow during this time period, we'll be speaking about the whole issue with Doris Meisner. She's former commissioner of the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service. She is now with the Migration Policy Institute, director of U.S. Immigration Policy Program. But I forgot to give you the number for the whole hour for All Things Political. We're on this issue and many others. Our number for you to chime in is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter @KDunnShow. The Hobby Lobby decision by the Supreme Court got most of the attention, so why don't we spend some time talking about their ruling in Harris versus Quinn, which could eventually, my understanding is, it could affect hundreds of thousands of unionized home health care workers. I know that you have written extensively about the cost of public sector pay and benefits, and if we fail to rein in this growth, we could have severe financial problems. Would it be safe to say that would you say that Harris versus Quinn decision did not go far enough, Daniel?
Well, I think this decision, probably in some ways, it didn't satisfy critics of public employee unions that would have liked to have seen Justice Alito and the others in the majority take the logic of their argument about agency fees and, in a sense, forced union dues. They'd like to see them take that logic further and eliminate that in the public sector for government workers. Again, that wouldn't affect private workers. On the other hand, critics of this decision went too far down that line or that logic. So this was a decision that, in a sense, satisfied neither side on this issue. Longer term, I think the decision does set up a case. I mean, Justice Alito's opinion in this case and in a prior case called Knox versus SEIU has really laid the basis for a decision in a case that maybe fits the circumstances a little bit better for a real challenge to fair share fees in the public sector on the basis of the First Amendment. We can talk more about what that would look like if you'd like.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit. I know you've written extensively about public sector unions and the political clout of state workers' unions, also the cost of public sector pay and benefits. Do you see down the road, as has been the case in Wisconsin, Daniel, more states going like Wisconsin that we're going to see? We've already seen a big drop in private sector unions. The same will be true of public sector unions?
Well, in some part, this was the case that was at issue in Harris versus Quinn, that the court could have gone much further and, in a sense, created a right-to-work law for the public sector that would have applied nationally, and that would have, in a sense, made the rest of the country much more like Wisconsin. As to will other states independently take action, I think that there's some states, and, you know, again, the Midwest has been the center point of these battles in Wisconsin, in Indiana, in Michigan. Down the line, you might see efforts to move in that direction with states that need to compete with other Midwestern states for jobs, such as Pennsylvania. But in big unionized states like New York and California, there's very little political force that could potentially push back against the unions.
Mm-hmm. If you look at the situation in Wisconsin, maybe it will change over time, but it does strike me that you've got really people who are very upset with each other. You've got people upset with teachers. You've got teachers upset with the politics in Wisconsin. It doesn't make for a very happy populace.
That may or may not prove to be the case. Of course, change in any political environment is difficult, and this in Wisconsin, as in other places where public employee unions have enjoyed substantial collective bargaining and union protection rights going back now nearly 40 years, in those places, people were very used to a set of arrangements in public sector labor relations, and change in those areas is clearly going to be unwelcome for the people who are on the receiving end of that change.
Let's go to the Mideast. Once again, more violence here, and this one is so sad. The deaths of three Jewish teenagers, the revenge killing of a Palestinian teen, and beating of a Palestinian-American. Horrible, horrible deaths. You worry about an escalation, as if you need anything more to escalate tensions that are already pretty high.
Yeah, this story is, an incredibly tragic one on both sides. One could only pray for, the better angels of people's nature to take hold. But it's not clear, in this complicated environment of the Israeli governance of the West Bank territories, what could be done? The Israelis have obviously taken some steps to prosecute the perpetrators of the killing of the Palestinian teen. I'm sure that story will be followed quite closely. Whether the Palestinians make any efforts detain or arrest and prosecute those responsible for the deaths of the Israeli teenagers still remains to be seen.
Mm-hmm. And finally from me, before we go to our many calls, waiting patiently to speak with you, what do you think about all these customers? This is a huge number of people in Detroit who don't have water. 12,500 customers had their water shut off in Detroit, and the average delinquency is $560.
Yeah, this is a tough story.
It is.
It's a difficult situation. Detroit is trying to, I think, is in a position where the city is obviously, it's bankrupt. It's hurting for finding revenue for paying for basic services. Detroit also has a large problem with abandoned properties. Mm-hmm. There's more than 10,000 of them, and the city is trying to work to identify what those properties are. And then either move them into foreclosure and put them on the market. This is part of a broader strategy of the city to identify which properties are abandoned, what, and then move, in some sense, to try to sustain or maintain property values, because if the city continues to lose population, the property values are going to continue to fall, property taxes will fall with it, and the city will not be able to ever emerge from bankruptcy. Is that putting some customers here in a very, very difficult position? Yes.
Should government have the right to turn off that many people's water? Is some of it said this is a human right? We need it to survive.
Right, and that's the question. Should they be able to turn it off? And certainly at the level of delinquency, the number sounds like a lot. How many of these units are actually inhabited? That's another question that I don't think as yet we have a good figure. It sounds like this was turned off to 12,000 homes. Are all of these homes occupied? I don't know. And in Detroit, that's, I think, a real question. But it certainly is a very difficult position for people who are behind in their water payments, and some people who are on fixed incomes and potentially unable to come up with $560 at the drop of a hat.
Mm-hmm. Daniel DeSalvo is our guest, and it's all things political you're listening to here on the Ideas Network. We're welcoming phone calls. Our lines are filled right now, but you'll get through eventually. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. Hour two of our program today, we'll be talking, get your pens and papers out, because we're going to compile one marvelous summer reading list with Daniel Golden from Boswell Books. He and his staff have come up with all kinds of recommendations, fiction, nonfiction, children's books, light read, very serious reads. So it's great suggestion, hour two of the show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. Daniel DeSalvo is our guest, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute Center for State and Local Leadership and assistant professor of political science at the City College of New York. Phil in Madison is our first caller. Hey, Phil.
Hello.
Go right ahead, Phil.
All right, well, my question is about how the child immigration story is being reported. I really don't think it's very probable that 50,000 8-year-olds could have made it from Guatemala or Honduras to the U.S. without the help of some adults. And that's really the story, isn't it? How come we're not talking about that?
Well, there's certainly an aspect of this that I think, you know, some people closer to the border and in California who are very upset about this, and conservative critics of the president have put their finger on the fact that adults are ultimately using these children as pawns in a larger game, which is to say that they're the ones that are ultimately making the decision to send them north alone and by themselves. And there's a whole host of adults and intermediaries, sometimes called coyotes, that have facilitated their transit from Central America to the U.S. border.
I'm always amazed how little reporting. It seems as though every now and then these events happen and you have to play catch-up, the news media does, to find out what indeed is going on in Honduras and El Salvador and Guatemala. Is it indeed incredibly safe, unsafe? Are there so many gangs that you can hardly walk around if you're a child and you're being recruited and made to join a gang? Or is poverty so substantial that nobody can get enough food to eat? There's very little reporting that's going on inside those countries, so we get a better understanding of this whole situation.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the Central American countries, especially Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, are, you know, some of the poorest in Latin America in general, and, you know, have been plagued in recent years by these very virulent set of gangs, Mara Salvatrucha and others, that have also become mixed up in the drug trafficking and drug trade.
Right.
So in some sense, if we think about even Mexico, which obviously is a much larger, much more stable economy, but has been plagued with its drug problems as well in its drug war, really the big violence areas are really near the border with the United States and near the border with Guatemala.
Mm-hmm. Adam in Benton. Hi.
Hello. I understand it sucks that there are loads of kids at the border from these countries, but one, we have so many issues here in our own country that we're not handling. Soldiers that have come home and living on the streets with PTSD, how many kids in our foster care system that aren't really getting squared away. There are so many issues, and yeah, it sucks that these kids ended up getting sent here, and it sucks where they're coming from. But we need to take responsibility for our own people. And I know that we have, in those countries, they have law enforcement or they have some type of government system to where we should be able to put these kids on a bus and safely get them to Guatemala, Ecuador, wherever they're coming from, and give them back to their government and their government handle getting them back home. Coming up with $2 billion, taking it out of taxpayer money, wherever it's coming from, that's $2 billion that we could be using somewhere here to help our own country and stop having so many economic issues and so many other issues that are here. It doesn't add up to do this. So that's my two cents.
Thanks for your two cents, Adam. Daniel.
Well, this is a very delicate and difficult issue. I think the president's request for $2 billion in additional funds, some of this will be used for dealing with and transporting all of these youngsters back to their home countries, but not all of the money is simply for that. And again, I think that the responsible thing for the U.S. federal government to do is to ensure the safe transit of all of these young people back to their home countries and arrange things, as the caller suggested, with the home governments if the parents or responsible guardians can't be located, which in the fluid and difficult conditions in those countries is certainly within the realm of possibility. In that regard, I mean, I also agree with the caller that there are many other pressing and important priorities to take care of here at home in the United States. But if you think about the U.S. federal budget as a whole, $2 billion sounds like a lot of money, but in the whole scheme of the U.S. federal budget, it's not very much money at the end of the day.
The caller mentioned soldiers who have returned who are suffering from post-traumatic stress. We should spend a little while on Iraq. What do you make of the mess that country is in once again after the huge loss of life and people coming back with severe injuries? Do you think that it's just tumbling? Can you see any way for us to do anything good in Iraq?
Well, it's very difficult to see how the U.S. might intervene at this point. The issue is that clearly the country is now, de facto divided into almost three countries, with the Kurdish autonomous region more in the north, now a Sunni region in the west dominated by ISIS, and then the Shiite region in the south, with Baghdad, which obviously is a mixed capital with all different, each of the ethnic and religious faiths of the country represented there. How the U.S. could intervene and help with airstrikes without putting troops back into Iraq is very difficult to see at this point. The great problem right today in the Middle East is, of course, the Sunni states are, in some sense, all their strategic incentives are to push against the more Shiite bloc of the government in Hezbollah, with the Assad regime in Syria, and of course Iran, lined up against the Arab sheikdoms and the Saudi monarchy.
You know, Daniel, it doesn't seem like all that long ago, maybe a year ago, we were doing shows here talking about the effectiveness of the anti-terrorist operation the U.S. was conducting. And I remember people saying very clearly, we've done a great job. We've really targeted al-Qaeda. We have been successful. We've killed off a lot of these terrorist leaders. And now all of a sudden we get these, I don't know what the numbers are actually, but I hear 10,000 members of ISIS and this huge terrorist threat again. Now we're worried about airplane travel, and here it is all back. What happened to the billions and billions we have spent on anti-terrorism?
Well, in some respects, this was working well, but the Arab Spring really changed the equation. The United States had done reasonably well in establishing alliances in western Iraq with Sunni tribal leaders to hold down violence there, and that strategy proved effective. But as the U.S. withdrew, the central government in Baghdad under Prime Minister Maliki didn't incorporate any of those people from the Sunni regions into the government, and in fact excluded them, which in a sense pushed them back into the budding arms of terrorist groups or radical Islamic groups that were then flourishing in the violence of the Syrian civil war.
All right, let's go back to phone calls. Let me reiterate the number. It's 800-486-8655. This is the hour of the week that we look at what's going on politically and welcome your phone calls and your thoughts about issues that we bring up and that you may want to bring up that we haven't talked about yet. Our guest is Daniel DeSalvo. He is senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute Center for State and Local Leadership. He's also an assistant professor of political science at the City College of New York. Willem and Colfax, hi.
Hi. I wanted to bring up something that I heard about that happened in the state of New York. And there were two towns, Dryden and Middlefield in upstate New York, which had were interested in banning fracking in their towns and were sued by a company called Norse Energy that they couldn't do that. But anyway, on Monday, last Monday, in a 5-2 decision, the New York State Court of Appeals upheld a lower court ruling in favor of the towns. In other words, that the towns, that local towns and people have the right to determine what happens in their communities. And that's relevant to what's happening in Wisconsin with Senator Tom Tiffany's, Republican Senator Tom Tiffany's attempts to limit or, stop local control in regards to frac sand mining. So I think that that's an interesting ruling, that actually the court ruled that the people, not corporations, have the right to determine what happens in their communities. So I think that's encouraging, especially in light of all the trouble that's been happening with fracking. The USGS has a report that links fracking to earthquakes. There's problems with drinking water contamination. There's all sorts of problems. And like I say, in Wisconsin here, there are 120 operating mines and more on the way, and there's very little control by our state DNR as far as air and water quality. And so I think this is an important issue.
Thank you very much, Daniel.
Certainly this was an interesting decision here in New York. New York State has a moratorium on fracking, so horizontal drilling and hydrofracking is not happening in New York State. The Governor Cuomo has issued a moratorium until a health study that's been going on for almost his entire first term is concluded, and everyone realizes, I think at this point, that this really isn't a health study but a political ploy to wait until after the governor's reelection, and then he'll consider whether or not to allow fracking in New York State. Clearly, the industry has flourished just across the border from the southern tier of New York State and Pennsylvania. The court decision that the caller mentioned does give cities and towns the right to ban fracking within their jurisdictions. Of course, that could be overturned by a new state law should the governor and the state legislature decide to allow fracking. And it may be the case that even allowing some communities to not allow fracking within their jurisdiction should New York states begin to allow fracking, would still facilitate investment by oil and gas companies. On the other hand, the uncertainty that that power being so decentralized would introduce, other people argue that would mean that, you know, ultimately if that decision held in New York state at this point, given how fracking is flourishing in many, many other parts of the country, that New York state may ultimately end up missing the boat of the natural gas revolution in the United States.
The other story, though, that was coming out last week was the number of earthquakes experienced in Kansas this year and the number in Oklahoma. And in Kansas, I believe, or perhaps it was Oklahoma, I can't remember which one, instead of the normal three, there were hundreds of earthquakes. I read the story and said, oh my gosh, this is amazing. I didn't know that there were that many earthquakes. And the articles I was reading referenced a study that had been done in Oklahoma where some scientists have directly linked this to fracking. It does appear that maybe we need to know a little bit more about this, right? We don't want a whole lot more earthquakes.
No, that's true. I think there's lots of studies going, being conducted. Again, tying these things causally to earthquakes is complicated. Of course, fracking as a technique is something that's been going on and been used in the oil and gas industry for many, many years. Obviously, what's new about it is allowing the horizontal drilling that they couldn't do before, so new techniques. So whether this is so different from what was being done when people simply drilled straight down to being able to drill down and sideways, whether that's something that's going to really create or cause more earthquakes is, I think, still the subject of some dispute. And your caller mentioned studies that have tied this to contamination of drinking water. To my knowledge, there hasn't been a single confirmed report of contamination of drinking water anywhere in the country. There's been much speculation that this would happen, but to date, there's been no confirmed instance of that happening.
Well, what do you think we as a people do, though, when we suspect that this kind of fracking horizontal may contribute to the huge increase in the number of earthquakes? What should our response be as a people to make sure that we get the truth on this, to continue with this kind of fracking, or what do we do?
Well, clearly you would want to get the truth. You'd want to get the truth and the best scientific evidence, and hope that policymakers would take that into account in designing regulations that would allow for the safe and secure exploitation of this important natural resource.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email that's come in on Facebook from Tim. I went to Honduras on a home building mission trip last year, and the pastor of the church we stayed with was so concerned for our safety that he had Honduran soldiers with M16s protect us at all times. Our first day there, a drive-by shooting occurred a half mile from our work site. Listeners keep calling in saying we have our own problems, just send them back. But having personally experienced the security situation there and meeting the families and children who are fleeing this war zone, I believe our government is morally required to protect and welcome these refugees.
Yeah, I think that this is, your callers are really showing, reflecting the two sides of this difficult debate that the administration has found thrown into its lap about what to do with what's the responsible thing to do here. Now that these children have arrived in the United States, or at least at the border, how can they be sent back and again ensure their safety, or in some instances, some among them, if they can't be sent back due to threats to their family from drug cartels or the gangs? Better to be safe than sorry, and be a little slower in returning these people to their country than to immediately send them back as quickly as possible as one would with adults.
So you would agree then that many of these people may have valid asylum claims?
Well, that's a complicated legal question. Again, they may be in the future. It's a little hard to say whether 8-year-olds are going to make asylum, can make asylum claims. Some may be able to, but again, I think that's a complicated legal distinction that, at least for now, we would have to see whether something else couldn't be done, because if that would also implicate whether their parents who are sending them had, if, you know, there's no one to care for them there in their home countries. That's not to say that there isn't danger, and again, I think that there is danger present, and sending them back and how to send them back is a more complicated issue than it first appears.
Eric in Endeavor, hello.
Hello. Hey, your guest said that $2 billion isn't very much money in the scheme of things, but $2 billion and $2 billion and $2 billion shreds up pretty quick. And I just did some quick math on my cheap cell phone calculator, and I divided $2 billion times 50,000 children. That's $40,000 each child to get them back there. And I'm pretty sure by myself, without a group rate like that, I could get to Honduras for like $500 or $600. I don't understand why it takes 40 grand to get each kid back to Honduras. That doesn't make any sense.
Well, the money is not just for the bus trip back. Detention facilities are overcrowded. You've got health checks that need to take place. Some of these people will indeed be reunited with some family members in parts of the country. You've got more Border Patrol people. I mean, you've got all kinds of people, Homeland Security. There are a lot of agencies involved. It's not just the bus trip, is it, Daniel?
No, I think, Kathleen, you're pointing to the right thing. You've got facilities to feed, clothe, and house these youngsters. And in that respect, keeping the lights on and the water running, all of that is part of the cost of dealing with this tragic and difficult situation. I also do agree with your caller that, while $2 billion in and of itself isn't a lot of money in the federal budget, spending to deal with crises on our borders and around the world does add up and quite quickly.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Eric, for your call. Sylvia in Evansville, hi.
Yes, and thank you for taking my call. See, while I'm not particularly politically adroit, well, my question is in essence, has there been a thorough root cause analysis of why these kids, the basis of the crisis, why they're coming here? Now, the argument can be framed, they're sending their kids here to get benefits from American largesse, but in essence, as the prior caller had mentioned, my understanding is that the level of violence in Central America has escalated incredibly, and many people might be sending their kids here to get to safe haven. And in Syria, where there's internal conflict due to, obviously, violence between sects and tribes, Turkey and Jordan, little countries, small budgets, are providing safe haven for immigrants. And here in Central America, where we may be the major market for the illicit use of such drugs, how can we not afford to take care of these kids when there's a failed state?
Thank you.
That would be my question.
Thank you, Sylvia, for the call. Daniel?
Well, I think, again, it's a very complicated situation in Central America today. The motivation, I think, of probably the vast majority of these parents that are, one can only imagine the great difficulty with which it takes to send your 8-year-old on a 1,000-mile journey by themselves, one must believe that circumstances are quite dire in order to do that. Usually people are really probably doing this just in hopes of giving their child an opportunity at a better life. The unfortunate reality is that these are not failed states. They're functioning governments in all of these countries. In fact, some of them are rather vibrant democracies that have had elections and so on in recent years. Are they plagued with violence from gangs and from drug cartels? Absolutely. And does that put many civilians at risk in these countries in a way that is sometimes difficult from our side of the border to comprehend? Definitely.
Mm-hmm. Well, you also have to wonder if we could not be looking at some kind of North America, Central America solution to this. Somebody suggested that maybe there are other places to go. Costa Rica, the happiest country on earth, for heaven's sake. Panama, I don't know what their immigration policies are, but there is something that makes people believe that coming to the United States will be nirvana.
Mm-hmm. That's certainly been one of the mythologies of immigrants going back two centuries. Peasants from Sicily, my grandparents, mm-hmm. Certainly had that image in their mind, and in order to undertake a very long and difficult journey.
Yes.
From outside of Palermo to New York City.
Right. And we all have those stories, don't we? Similar kinds of circumstances that our ancestors took these very dangerous journeys, and they didn't know what they were coming into.
Mm-hmm.
And they built the country. So you got to factor out, well, it's a complicated situation. We're going to move mostly to other topics now, with a reminder that tomorrow, the first hour of our program, we'll talk about the intricacies of all of this with Doris Meisner, who's the former commissioner of the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service. So that's hour one of our show. This hour, it's All Things Political. Daniel DeSalvo is our guest. He's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute Center for State and Local Leadership, assistant professor of political science at the City College of New York, writes for all kinds of publications, and we'll be back with more of your phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Sarah in Zion is our next caller. Hi, Sarah.
Okay, hi. About the fracking, your fracking statement that there's never been a documented case of groundwater contamination, someone said to me, oh, the MIT report on the future of fracking says that there's never been a documented case of that. So I looked it up, and I read the report online, and it clearly says in the summary of the report that there have been several documented cases of that, and it's been mostly, according to them, it was mostly the fault of smaller companies with less experience doing the fracking. But so I don't think you can have that statement about there hasn't been any contamination. Thanks.
Thank you, Sarah.
Well, I guess what the original caller was getting at, we can make the split hairs about groundwater versus drinking water contamination. And what I was trying to suggest that there hadn't been any contamination drinking water, no reported cases, broader groundwater issues, sure, but those obviously can be very far from drinking water supplies.
Let's go to Jim in Milwaukee next. Our number is 800-486-8655. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I just wanted to talk about the general issue of trust and how difficult it must be for conservatives, especially the Tea Party people, to trust the Country Club Republicans in the context of how things are going. With the regulatory agencies, can we really trust the Republicans to support regulations that will protect people? Not just the fracking issue, but also transport of oil in oil cars, and also the explosion of the fertilizer plant in Texas. There are a lot of examples where they have not shown themselves to be trustworthy. In foreign policy, I just quickly refer to the idea that we try to occupy and control everywhere in the world, and that the country that tries to stay forever pays forever. And we're constantly paying the cost of these wars that were started by misinformation in the first place, especially in Iraq. And I would suggest that the immigration inflow of young children comes up about as a result of the carryover from the dirty deeds that were done during the Iran-Contra war, when they let the Contras run cocaine into the country to fund the Contras off the books. And finally, I just point out how torn up Mississippi Tea Party people must be, because all these years the Country Club Republicans have made their living Willie Hortonizing people, playing whites against blacks. And now when the Country Club Republicans were up against it in Mississippi, they encouraged black votes to cross over to defeat their opponents. And so, to me, the Country Club Republicans are constantly cheaters and will do anything to win. And I don't see how the entirety of the Republican Party can trust them.
Daniel.
Well, there's a lot there in what your caller has to say. Clearly, just a couple of quick points. Clearly, there's an ongoing conflict between the Tea Party faction and the rest of the Republican Party across a range of issues. Clearly, the Tea Party candidates have had difficulty in many of the primaries, Mississippi and elsewhere. and in this primary season, and that's been really the Tea Party's problem of in general of in that sense of trying to expand its influence, is its inability to field candidates that that can win either at the stage of primary elections or at the stage of general elections. I think the caller also raises an important issue about public policy in the United States, which is the overall standing of government's credibility to do all kinds of things. And if the public doesn't have sufficient trust in government, there isn't sufficient credibility of what the government complying or doing what it says it's going to do, can often, in a sense, undermine what the government is in fact trying to do. So I think that's a deep and important issue that the caller raises.
You know, we are on the subject of elections, too. I haven't thought about them very much. And then I was thinking, I really haven't thought about these. And the midterm elections are not that far away. We're usually talking about these years before, aren't we, Daniel? Do you want to say something about them?
Well, yeah, I think it's it's an interesting phenomenon what's happened over the last few election cycles. Our midterm elections have really become nationalized, and in that respect, they've been bellwethers of how the president or the majority party is doing. They've been hotly contested for control of one or both chambers of the Congress. In this case, it's the middle of the summer. Primary season has passed. I think it'll probably be another month or so before the country really starts to pay attention to the fall election campaign. But for the most part, a lot of this campaign season so far has really hinged on more localized issues afflicting particular states and particular districts around the country, and hasn't had a unifying national theme in the way that the past few midterm elections of 2010, 2006, for example.
Let's go next to Mitch in Green Bay. Hi.
Hello. I wonder if the Colorado tax revenue off of marijuana is really legitimate, but they made it sound pretty good. But if it is, maybe we should just legalize the drugs, use the tax revenue off of that to solve our immigration problem, and we probably have more than enough money to handle that. And it might, I don't know if we're ever going to wean our people off of this drug addiction. And I don't know if we're going to, wean those countries off of that easy money.
Daniel.
Well, a very interesting proposal by the caller. The only trouble is that as things matter stand right now, the federal government is not in the business of legalizing the consumption of marijuana for recreational or medical purposes. It still remains a controlled substance that's illegal. So federal law is in contradiction to these state laws, or in tension with them at least. And in that respect, other states follow deem it wise to follow the model of Washington State and Colorado in a sense, tax people's vices and legalize marijuana for recreational purposes, that would be revenue going to the state governments and not going to the federal government, which is the one that's ultimately responsible for immigration policy.
I read something over the weekend that Colorado's running out of marijuana. Did you see that?
I did not, no.
Yeah. So then you got the question of making sure you've got all the right supplies everywhere.
Right.
Yeah. Well, you never know who's going to call in with what on this hour, and we thank you for being a great sport and for being knowledgeable about so many issues, Daniel. Thanks.
My pleasure.
Daniel DeSalvo, our guest for All Things Political. This show always takes place on Mondays. Every Monday from 1 until 2, we do a show, All Things Political, and we have people with a variety of political viewpoints and affiliations with us. Daniel, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute Center for State and Local Leadership. He also teaches political science at the City College of New York. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to KP for on-air production. I do want to remind you, because we had so many calls on immigration and those children and mothers with young children who are trying to get into this country. Tomorrow, immigration for the first full hour of our show with Doris Meisner. She is former commissioner of the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service, and she is now director of the U.S. Immigration Policy Program at the Migration Policy Institute. So stay with us for that. Thanks, everybody, for listening and for your calls on many topics. News coming up momentarily from National Public Radio, and then we'll be back with another hour here on the Ideas Network.